Hey guys, check it out. Donations of $50 or more to the Libertarian Institute or to scotthorton.org, and you get a signed copy of the paperback book. Sign up for the podcast feeds at scotthorton.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and all of that, especially for the interview feed. I need to do a new Q&A show for you guys, I know. But anyway, all that is there. Patreon.com, if you want to support at patreon.com, any new supporter at a dollar or more at patreon.com/Scott Horton Show, you get 2 free audiobooks. Shop amazon.com by way of my link at scotthorton.org. Leave a good review for me at iTunes or Stitcher or amazon.com if you read Fool's Errand and like it. I appreciate it. And help share these shows on Facebook and Twitter.
Sorry, I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
Well, it's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again, you've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
Well, we ain't killing they army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, bitch, say it 3 times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, on the line, I've got Joe Loria, and he's a veteran foreign affairs journalist, as they say here at consortiumnews.com. He's written for the Boston Globe, the Sunday Times in London, and the Wall Street Journal. He used to cover the UN for the Wall Street Journal for many years. He's the author, really the editor in a way, of How I Lost by Hillary Clinton, which is just a great collection of block quotes. Very important historical work there. How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. Welcome back to the show. How you doing, UN Joe?
I'm fine. Thank you, Scott. Thank you very much.
Happy to have you here. Now, you're currently in exile from your home in Iraqi Kurdistan. Is that correct?
Well, more or less. I'm not sure I'm going back to Iraq. First, I can't go back if I wanted to because the flights are still suspended into the Kurdish region in Iraq. So I'm exiled at a resort near the Dead Sea in Egypt, and I can't complain too much.
All right. Yeah, that doesn't sound
But smart. I left just before they were going to shut down the flights.
All right.
In reaction to the referendum.
Right. Now, so that's the news here. No, I couldn't believe it. No wonder it's the top headline on antiwar.com right now. Iraqi Kurdistan president resigns after independence vote backfires. Barzani will continue to fight for independence. He's resigning as of November the 1st. What all do you know? They're going to hold new elections, or what's the deal?
Well, they were supposed to hold new elections on November 1st, which I think is the reason he called this referendum. He has to resign. This guy would never resign, no matter what happened. So it had to be pretty bad what he did to force him to resign, and it was pretty bad. He has damaged his people immeasurably by this irresponsible holding of this referendum. I've talked to you before about this a couple of times. There are legal and legitimate historical reasons for Kurdish people in Iraq and elsewhere, in Turkey, Iran, and Syria, to want to be independent, but the political realities were that this was a complete romantic fantasy and a dangerous one. And the reason he called it now is because there were elections for November 1st. And Masoud Barzani, who's been in charge for a long time, did not have legitimacy in the last 2 years. His term ran out 2 years ago. He got a judge to extend it for 2 years, but that was ending at the end of this month. So that's why there were going to be new elections on November 1st, and he hoped to be elected on the back of this referendum, which was wildly successful and popular amongst his people. 93% voted in favor. It was not it was binding, but it was not a declaration of independence like we've seen in Catalonia. Right. He was going to enter into negotiations with Baghdad for his sovereignty, but of course, the Iraqi central government said no. And the Turks and the Iranians cracked down, closing the border, threatening blockade, shutting down the flights. And then Barzani suffered the biggest defeat of his career, which has forced him to resign. because the Iraqi army marched in and without a hardly a shot fired, took back Kirkuk, which had been disputed since the American invasion of Iraq, and took back the oil fields, 30% of the oil revenue that he was dependent on, that he was selling illegally to Turkey. So this has been a huge blow, not only to independence aspirations of his Kurdish people, but of the economy of an autonomous region that was doing extremely well, considering probably better than Kurds have ever lived anywhere at any time, with this autonomy that was formally acknowledged by the Baghdad government after the American invasion, after the fall of Saddam Hussein, and had been a de facto autonomous region since the no-fly zone was put in by George H.W. Bush and the UN Security Council back in 91. So they were doing pretty well, but he got greedy. He thought he could, on the back of this referendum, he could get elected, and instead he lost Kirkuk. He's lost other disputed areas. He's lost 30% of his oil, and more importantly, he shut down the flights, but more importantly, he opened up the rift with the Talibani faction of the Kurdish Iraqis. And this, there were two clans, really, the Barzan clan from Barzan, a town in the mountains in Iraqi northern Iraq, and the Talibani crowd, which is centered in Sulaymaniyah, the second largest city. They fought after their autonomy under the American air cover of the no-fly zone in 1991, they then fought a three-year bitter civil war in which thousands died inside the Kurdish region to see who would run this new autonomous region under American protection. And it was the Clinton White House that brokered a deal to stop the killing. And there was a power-sharing agreement. Barzani got in control that was in 1997, and that lasted until now. He was really in charge all this time. But at that time in the Clinton White House agreement, there was no integration of their Peshmerga and their intelligence forces. So while they were under Barzani's nominal leadership, the Talibani clan based in Sulaymaniyah had their own Peshmerga and their own intelligence. And this became very important in what happened at Kirkuk early this month. Because when the Iraqi army went in, they were faced with 6,000 Peshmerga. People like me thought that it would be a bloodbath. Thousands of Kurds fled from the city, expecting a bloodbath. And in fact, the Peshmerga stood down. And why? Because they were loyal to the Sulaymani Talibani crowd. So that is what screwed Barzani. The Talibani Peshmerga did not fight. And that's the end of Masoud Barzani.
Uh-huh. And now it's interesting, though, that so then I had seen where Barzani had blamed the Talibani guys and said, oh, it's treason that you didn't stay and fight, which, of course, is easy for him to say when it wasn't his forces that were there. But so this has hurt him, but only to their benefit, because the Talibani faction then are the only other game in town, right?
No, there is another game. It's called the Goran Movement, which means change in English, the change movement. They're a split off from the PUK, which is the Talibani party. The Talibani's party, PUK, is a split off from the Kurdish Democratic Party, which is Barzani's party. So there have been two major splits here in the last 20 years or so. So the Goran change movement, which are left of center, and they don't like either one, and they actually have the largest party, the second largest party in the parliament. They had shut down the parliament because Barzani would not step down when his term ended 2 years ago. So they're looking pretty good right now. They opposed the referendum, at least part of them. In the Talibani's group, in the PUK, there was a split about whether to support the referendum or not, and there was a split even about whether the Peshmerga should have stepped aside in Kirkuk or not. So there's a real split within that as well, to make this more complicated if it isn't already. So the Goran change movement is the one to look at, whether they can win in this next election, whenever it's going to be, because it was canceled on November 1st, because Barzani knew he would lose. So what he's done is he's staying in, you know, as a Peshmerga leader, but he's appointed his nephew, the prime minister, as the new leader of the party. So the nepotism continues, the corruption, forget about it. So we're going to see now when this election is going to be held. They haven't announced the date yet, but the Goran movement or the change party is the one to keep your eye on. They could win a majority, and that would mean huge changes in the Kurdish region.
All right, so now here's the all-important question, right, is not just who controls the city of Kirkuk, but who controls all of the adjacent oil fields. And I guess the question is whether the Shiite Iraqi government in Baghdad and the Iraqi Kurdish government, whoever is the dominant faction actually on the ground there, whether it's the Peshmerga, the Iraqi army, or either way, that they're both willing to compromise and work together and share the wealth from those oil fields. Otherwise, there's going to be a war over them, right? Neither side is going to let the other side just have them. Am I wrong?
Well, Barzani, you know, has lost those oil fields. So that's the reason he's stepping down, because this referendum cost him that, those oil fields to the Iraqi government. Will the Iraqi government now want to share that wealth with even a chastised regional government? Well, it remains to be seen who's going to lead the Kurdish region. If Barzani's party still wins, that might not be so easy, because they're the ones responsible for this entire mess.
Yeah.
But if the Goran party or the PUK, the Talibani groups, win, there could be some kind of negotiations. I think the central government, and you're right to point out that they're Shiite, and that there's a sectarian part of this, because the Kurds are Sunni. And while they want a national unity and the Kurds are a main part, you know, the Shia leadership has to be seen to be more tolerant of Sunnis as well. So they're in a dodgy position, but they have taken control now of those oil fields. So they're in the driver's seat right now.
Well, they've been in a full-scale alliance, really, since 2003 or even before in the years of Bill Clinton and Iraq War 1.5. The Shia and the Kurds were sort of in an alliance against, or at least in resistance against, Saddam Hussein's regime at that time. And then especially since 2003, it's been those two major factions aligned versus the Sunni Arabs there, right?
Yeah, the changing. I mean, during that mid-90s civil war that I described, between the Talibani and Barzani factions, at one point, Barzani allied with Saddam Hussein, a bitter enemy against Talibani. So these kinds of alliances shift very quickly. But right now, the Shia-led government in Iraq has won this round against the Kurds without doubt, and it's forced Barzani out. And we're going to see what happens, who's going to lead the Kurdish region, whether they can restore and retain the autonomy that they had and get back some oil revenue. But that oil revenue is going to have to go through Baghdad now. Then it will come down to Baghdad distributing tax revenue, which they'd withheld from the Kurdish region because the Kurds were illegally selling the oil. Mm. So these things have to be worked out. And hopefully with new leadership in the Kurdish region, they might be. But I don't know whether the Kurds will ever enjoy the same level of autonomy that they had. But there might be less corruption with a new government in there, and that would certainly benefit the people there.
All right, well, yeah, I'll tell you. I mean, I guess the question still remains, too, as long as we're at it. What about the predominantly Sunni Arab regions of Iraq? I talked about this with Patrick Coburn a little bit the other day in Fallujah and Ramadi. I guess Ramadi was, you know, a much more mixed city even recently. But Mosul, of course, is almost entirely a Sunni Arab city, or was. But Ramadi has been almost completely flattened. There's not much to come back to there. I don't know what's going on in Tikrit. I don't know. Like, do you have is there a way you can estimate for us, Joe, what you think the Baghdad government's policy is for the near term about what to do with these cities that have been liberated from Islamic State? Because after all, the Shiite government's terrible relationship with these predominantly Sunni regions, which they had basically cast out as outlaws, really didn't even try to dominate them, but just kind of set them loose, which is what set them up to be dominated by the Islamic State instead. But so who's got a plan? I mean, what are they going to do? There's millions and millions of people here who remain stateless.
You would hope that the Trump administration might have some ideas if they want to be involved and try to make amends for the destruction of the country that Bush administration prosecuted against them. But there has to be some alliance against any kind of extremism that comes up. And that could be the basis for some normalization of relations between Baghdad and the Anbar and the other Sunni areas in Western Iraq. But as far as reconstruction, aid, how much tax revenue is going to go there? I don't really have the details of that, but it would really be incumbent upon a government that doesn't want to be seen to be sectarian and Shia, and maybe less so, at least Americans say so, than Maliki was, the previous prime minister. Mm-hmm. But without doubt, you know, the Kurds and the Arab Sunni Iraqis see it as a Shia government with close ties to Iran. And there was talk that Iranian troops, not only Iranian militias, backed Shia militias, were involved in the Kirkuk operation. So there has to be some kind of reconciliation there. And I don't know what the plans are right now. They're not clear, and that should be. They should be clear.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing there that you mentioned is it's hard to be worse than Maliki, right? So if a body is willing to, you know, at all be, you know, generous and a good winner in this latest round, then it seems like, I mean, you couldn't do much worse than Islamic State, right? I guess they just got to figure out which Sunni tribal leaders to prop up that'll marginalize the jihadis and carry on as a sort of Sunni mini state there.
And pay them off, which is what the Americans were doing since 2003, right? Paying off tribal leaders.
Yeah. Well, oil was selling for a lot higher then, right? I mean, I don't know, Joe.
Yeah.
Iraq War 4, man. That's the only question. What's the shape of the next one here? I don't know. Patrick's recent article was like, maybe they're kind of running out of wars to fight. You know, that the differences have basically been settled and the new lines have been, you know, and everybody, as he's been saying for years, everybody's so sick and tired of the violence. I mean, that doesn't mean it's over, but it means that, you know, all the bravado is gone. Only last ditch efforts at this point, you know?
Yeah, they need a rest before the next round of violence begins. I'll go for that.
Yeah. Oh, man. All right. Well, so, I'm not sure. Oh, I know. As long as we're talking Kurdistan here, and we had spoken before about, and you mentioned this before, I think it's a really important point to reemphasize, that the referendum for independence was just sort of a popular referendum saying they would support such a move, but such a move was not made, the actual declaration of independence.
It was never intended
Iraqi
to be made.
Kurdistan.
It was going to be a negotiation.
Right. It was a political stunt, more or less. But then also the other side of that thing is everybody, as you put it, then overreacted like crazy. And that includes the Iranians. But I also saw a thing that said that the Iranian Kurds said, well, we want to hold a referendum, too. How come they get to have one and we don't?
Yeah.
And I wonder how much strength is behind that, how much, you know, Iranian nationalism is in play versus Kurdish sectarianism there. Whether the CIA is involved, as Seymour Hersh reported 10 years ago, back about U.S. support for PJAC there, which is sort of the Iranian branch of the PKK, as he put it there, in the redirection by Seymour Hersh, 2007. So, yeah, man, what's going on there? Is that really a big deal? And do you think the West is involved in helping stir that up?
Well, you know, first of all, there was, you know, I said it was overreaction because I thought that, but it turned out that this referendum was a pretext on a gilded platter, as I wrote, to Abadi to move in to take back Kirkuk. So it was a really stupid move in that regard because the overreaction worked because they took it out with minimum bloodshed, although there's been tension in other disputed areas. But as far as the Iranian Kurds and the Turkish Kurds, let's say, they've been in Turkey, they've been fighting for 30 years for independence, and there's been uprisings in Iran since before the Second World War, and there was that short-lived Mahabad Republic in 1946 in Iran, the only Kurdish state that's ever existed as an independent state for exactly 1 year. It started under Soviet occupation. And then a year later, the Iranians executed the leaders. So, there have been these. They don't need the Iraqi referendum to be stirred up, but it could cause another round of trouble in Iran. Now, whether the United States has been involved in Iran, yes, I believe Hersh's reporting back then, and I think that's why about American and Israeli involvement in northern Iran with the Kurds, because that's why I think Israel's one of the reasons Israel supported the Kurdish referendum, the only country in the whole world that openly supported that and would support the Kurdish independence. One, to break up an Arab country, which is a longstanding policy of Israel to break up their Arab neighbors, to weaken them, and two, to get a foothold in there with an embassy to work, I think, to infiltrate into Iran. This is just my speculation, but based on the history that we know from other Iraqi Israeli policies in the region and what Hersh wrote, that seems like a logical conclusion why Israel would want to be in there. So I don't know that the Americans are working to destabilize Iran right now, But that certainly seems to be on the cards if there's not going to be an open attack on the Iranians, which we hope not. But, you know, that's been happening in Baluchistan, too, in the south. The Americans and the Israelis have been working to stir up trouble there. And I think that's something the Iranian government is going to have to contend with for a long time. But the failure of Barzani's referendum is certainly a sigh of relief in Tehran and in Ankara as well,
right,
that it's not going to contribute to the troubles that are going to continue anyway, that they have with their Kurds.
All right, hang on just one second. Hey, guys, buy this book. It's by Hussein Badakhshani. It's on Amazon.com. It's called No Dev, No Ops, No IT. It's about the praxeology of informed IT decision-making. No Dev, No Ops, No IT. Also, The War State by Mike Swanson. Great history of the rise of the military-industrial complex after World War II. Also, Swanson does Wall Street Window investment advice. Then when you take his advice and you buy precious metals, you do it at Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc., rrbi.co, rrbi.co, and there's no premium if you pay with Bitcoin, rrbi.co, for all your precious metal needs. Anti-government propaganda at libertystickers.com. Get your book edited well at 3tediting.com. That's 3tediting.com. And get your website looking nice for the new year at expanddesigns.com/Scott. That's the guy that did the great website for Fool's Errand at foolserrand.us. Check that out, and then go to expanddesigns.com/Scott. All right, so let's talk about Russia here for a minute, Joe, for 15
hours. Yes.
So you got this big piece here at consortiumnews.com, the Democratic money behind Russiagate, and then, of course, as so often with the Democrats, it all starts with Bill Kristol. But anyway, we'll talk about that. And then also, there's big news today as Manafort has been indicted for money laundering and tax evasion from apparently a long time ago. None of that has anything to do with the campaign or anything of the rest of that.
Right.
Except that then there's this other thing, and this is the big news, and this is the stipulation of George Papadopoulos, who is a foreign policy advisor to the Trump campaign, who apparently was, as Empty Wheel put it, he was indicted or charged 26 days ago, and they're only finding out now that he's been working with the FBI ever since, I forget when exactly, and he's got some goods on somebody. I'll let you characterize that best you can. I know you've had a chance to look at that. So you want to start with the article or the breaking news? It's up to you.
Well, the breaking news first, he has been indicted for lying to the FBI. And from what I read, he lied about when he began working for the campaign. And that was in relation to meetings he was having with a Russian professor who apparently had contacts in the Kremlin and who told him, according to Papadopoulos' own admission to the FBI, according to this indictment, that the Russians had dirt on Hillary Clinton, sent thousands of emails they wanted to share with the campaign, and they wanted better relations with Trump. Now, let's just explain that for a second. Why would Russia want better relations with Trump? Why were they fearful of Clinton? Clinton called Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, Hitler. She wanted a no-fly zone in Syria. She supported NATO buildup of troops on the Russian border. Any Russian alive saw Hillary Clinton as an existential threat to Russia, whereas Donald Trump, for whatever reason, whether it was because he had financial entanglements, because he was genuinely had this position or he was being told by somebody to have this, did make remarks during the campaign that he wanted better relations with Russia, wanted détente with Russia that any sane person would think is the right move. But, you know, the Russian people, and I'm in contact with Russians every single day, so if the FBI ever asked me if I am, I better say yes. So before I'm indicted, they are disappointed, definitely disappointed in Donald Trump that he hasn't followed through on any of this. Many people realize that he was not sincere all along, but I think Russians banked on him being that, and they were happy he won. And it makes sense that they would want Donald Trump, not for any other reason but that. They don't care about American domestic issues only. They cared about Russia's relations with Russia, and Russia perceives the U.S. as being an aggressive force, trying to restore a Yeltsin-like figure like the Americans had in the 90s, which let Wall Street and the U.S. in conjunction with oligarchs run that country, basically, and acid stripped the whole place and impoverished the population. And Putin has brought back sovereignty over the economics and politics of the country, and that's why the Americans want him out, because he's blocking them from going back in there and blocking American hegemonic interests everywhere around that region. So that's why they want Putin out of there, and Clinton was one who wanted that, made it clear, and that's why they wanted Trump. Now, this guy lied about when he actually had the job or not. Now, this seems like really chicken feet, but this is a crime, lying to the FBI. It happens all the time. People have gotten on that, and then they're turned, as you say, you know, to work with them. Is more going to happen? We don't know, obviously. Now, as far as these emails go, whether they were emails or not, we don't know whether these are emails that later were given to WikiLeaks. We still have no evidence that Russia had any connection with WikiLeaks. And, of course, Julian Assange has denied that over and over again. And Craig Murray, the former British ambassador, Uzbekistan, associate of Assange, has said that he's met with a live person who, and he knows that this was a leak and not a hack. And we have William Binney of the NSA saying the same thing. So we still don't have any connection with WikiLeaks. We don't have any direct connection yet with Russia trying to interfere with the election. Then we have this indictment, which says the Manafort thing is irrelevant, as you pointed out, but we have this indictment, which says that they offered some dirt on Clinton. But what do we see? And this goes to my article now. What did we learn about the Steele document, Christopher Steele, for MI6 agent? We now know that the Clinton campaign and the DNC paid for his hire indirectly through the lawyer and then this Fusion GPS who hired Steele. This dossier, which has been until now anyway, was not deemed credible for the most part by the FBI or the CIA or the corporate media, which was largely partial to Clinton. They didn't run with the stories either because they couldn't confirm any of these fantastic stories, which are typical for a opposition research. Steele wrote it in a way that this was an intelligence report, but it was not an intelligence report. He's a former intelligence guy, but this was not vetted by people in his agency or by other intelligence agencies. There was no dissenting opinions like you get in a national intelligence estimate in the U.S. This was opposition research. This is full of dirt for mudslinging campaigns, wild accusations. It's not something that anybody would immediately believe, whether you're in the FBI or in the American newspaper. So, but this became, it looks like, the basis for the January 6th intelligence estimate by assessment by these three handpicked agencies, the FBI, the NSA, and the CIA, not the 17 agencies that have to be involved in an NIE with dissenting opinions. And even though Hillary Clinton in her new book continues to insist that all 17 agencies, including the Coast Guard, weighed in on this, it was only three agencies, and it was opposition research. At first, we were being asked to believe the word of intelligence officials that Russia interfered in the election without any evidence. Now we're being asked to believe opposition research paid for by the Democratic Party and the Clinton campaign. So this really weakens even more, I think, the so-called evidence. There is still no evidence, it seems, other than this opposition research and the CrowdStrike analysis of the DNC computers. The DNC did not allow the FBI to examine their servers after they learned that they were hacked, or if it was indeed a hack. They went to a private company called CrowdStrike, which is run by a Russian, anti-Putin Russian, with links to a senior fellow at the anti-Russia Atlantic Council. And within one day, they claimed that Russia had hacked this DNC computers because they saw fingerprints there from Russia, which include Cyrillic letters and the name of the first Soviet intelligence chief. Now, and he said it was a sophisticated operation. How sophisticated could that be if the Russians left behind such clues? So there's enormous doubt about that evidence. But the only evidence we have is the CrowdStrike analysis and this Steele dossier, both of which were paid by Democrats as opposition, first by opposition research and the other as an overnight blame of the Russians for hacking the computers of the DNC. So if, in fact, these emails were being offered by this professor to Papadopoulos, we see that we don't know that those emails were ever delivered, just like John Don Jr.'s meeting never turned up any opposition research on Clinton. But if, in fact, the Trump campaign was trying to get opposition research from and dirt on Clinton from the Russians, so did the Clinton campaign try to get dirt on Trump from Russians, because Steele's sources were all Russians who he doesn't even name. We just have source A, B, C, D, and E. And it's a opposition research paper that it's been very difficult to confirm by the FBI and the American media. So where are we at right now? I still don't think there's any real evidence that Russia interfered in the election. Both parties seem to want to get dirt on the other candidate from the Russians. Did the Russians have emails from Clinton? Most likely. Everybody's spying on one another and taking emails and breaking, and cyber warfare is going on, and the United States is a more powerful cyber warfare country than anyone else. So, frankly, I don't know how this story has been advanced, but we're going to see the mania, anti-Russian mania, and the Russian involvement in this campaign, which also I'm not even sure about the laws about collusion, whether that's even against the law, other than paying for campaign donations to either campaign. So I don't know how much has been advanced by all this hoopla today, Scott.
Well, Paul Krugman says that you must be a Trump sycophant, because everybody knows that this whole thing was all an operation by the Russians to install Donald Trump in power as president of the United States.
I can't stand Donald Trump, and I can't stand Hillary Clinton. I dislike both of them. I hope both of them fight each other and destroy one another in the process of this whole mess so that we could start over again. That's my position. And Paul Krugman is a complete partisan writer and has to be seen in that way.
All right. So... now, look, I want to point out, because you're kind of joking around about, boy, you know, I better get a lawyer and this and that, traveling around the world and writing critical things. And it sounds silly, right? Because after all, First Amendment, and it's not exactly a banana republic here in America, just all the governments that our government controls around the world. But then again, yeah, no, actually, antiwar.com has been listed as, whatever category of useful dupes of the Russians, not just agents of a foreign power. And antiwar.com has been investigated by the FBI before under the pretense, actually quite illegally, if you ask the ACLU, who's suing them over it, or I guess who successfully sued them and they settled. They used FISA. And this was the first time that the ACLU could prove that the FBI used the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act against an American journalistic organization quite illegally under the pretense that Garris and Raimondo were agents of whoever it was, I guess they were supposed to be, some Middle Eastern power or whatever, which of course was completely ridiculous. But so now it's the Securing America Initiative, which is one of these Kristolian deals. And you talk about here about Singer, and it was Bill Kristol's organization, the Free Beacon, and all this supported by Singer, who started all of this in the first place before handing it off to the Democrats, right? But so these guys have accused antiwar.com. That's where I work. And you know what? I've been happy to debunk accusations against Russia on the record here for at least a solid decade straight, better than that. So, and I'm happy to continue doing so. I haven't gone on RT in about 7 years, but I'm about to start going back on RT now. As long as I'm being accused of being an agent of a foreign power, I might as well try to get some books sold. You know, they keep inviting me.
Yeah, sure.
But anyway, so yeah, I mean, it sounds ridiculous, right? But then again, yeah, no, eventually I am going to be in a concentration camp with you and Jim Bovard and all my favorite writers, you know?
Well, we can still laugh about that. But it's getting serious. And there's a new list that came out last week from this group, European Values. They named over 2,000 people, individually named, who appeared on RT, and they were useful idiots. And they included UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, David Brock, the head of opposition research for Hillary Clinton, and CIA-friendly reporter David Ignatius. These were all considered useful idiots because they appeared on RT, a news channel that gives the Russian point of view, the way CNN gives the American point of view, and the BBC, the American point of view. And it is really getting, it is getting very dangerous. That whole stuff you discovered about the FBI.
No, don't you see, Joe?
How much I'm aware of.
No, see, sorry? It's a Russian false flag attack to discredit the Russia movement by blaming Ignatius. Yeah. Because that's the stupidest thing anybody ever heard in their entire lives, if they have any idea who David Ignatius is.
Exactly.
And who he's a useful idiot for.
Well, exactly. So, but these things are proliferating now, this mania, and it is very, very frightening to a class that I think sees themselves threatened by the collapse of their neoliberal policies and an angry populace growing that brought us a demagogue like Trump, and that Hillary Clinton lost because she couldn't understand or connect with this angry population. Now they feel threatened by them, so someone has to be blamed.
for stirring them up and giving them wrong information to divide our country. And that's the Russians. Now, you know, it's ridiculous. And I'm put you in a position of having to defend Russia all the time. It's just because some of these charges are so outlandish that they it's clear why they're doing it, because they need to deflect attention and blame, as she did for why she lost, onto the Russians. And, you know, it's just absurd. And but it's been a long thing going back from, they've revived it from the Cold War. It is a new Cold War, so we have a new McCarthyism budding. It can. Who knows how far this can go? But you can imagine, I'm sure you know how many well-educated Democratic people really believe all of this. Yeah. And believe without doubt that there was a Russian interference. And I want to see the evidence. I've always kept an open mind about this, but I've never seen any real evidence yet. Now they've offered these emails of 1,000 if this is true. So, you know, they were trying to hurt Clinton. It makes sense why they would. Did that turn the election? Were those emails even delivered? Did they give the emails to WikiLeaks? We still don't know that. And even if they did the WikiLeaks emails cost her the election? Is there nothing that Hillary Clinton did on her own that cost the election? Is nothing that this ruling class, what their neoliberal policies have done to anger working class Americans? No. The Russians.
Yeah.
Absurd.
Well, and of course, even if you ask them, they blame so many different things for the margin, beginning with sexism and, of course, the Russians and whatever unfair Pizzagate accusations and every other thing under the sun, Jim Comey and his unfair yeah. announcement that they were reopening the investigation based on Anthony Weiner's laptop there and all of this stuff. That's a pretty big margin when you add all that. In other words, like, yeah, lady, you lost. I mean, that's basically the deal.
I'm anyway. Reading her book right now. It's a very painful experience, but I have to read it because I'm writing a review of
it. I really want to. I've had such fun. You know, I can't stand her voice, so I've turned the TV off. I just can't stand listening. Yeah. But I love reading about all of her great quotes of self-pity. They're just all so much fun. I mean, that's enough to keep me interested in politics forever. I hope she never quits. And everybody's saying, I wish she would just go away. And I wish they would shut up, man. I love it. I wish that she would continue this sympathy tour for the rest of her life. And I hope that lasts decades and decades of like, did I ever tell you about that time that I almost became the president? It was so unfair.
I mean,
with
you know, it sounds like she's going to run again if you read this book, because a good deal of the book, more than half, is about how she really loves working class people.
Oh, my God.
And she gives all these examples of meetings that she had. And what you see are these public-private partnerships that had a little program in some small town to help a coal mining town get a few jobs, which I have, you know, problem with. But this is the liberal response to this systemic issue. It's putting a Band-Aid on a much bigger problem that she still cannot connect. You know, she's giving individual stories of people who are hurt, and those are good. But it's a class issue. It's not just about some one or two.
Hey, back on the subject real quick, because I'm almost out of time here, is it seems to me that one of these things, and I'm really not the expert in all this stuff. I guess I really should go back and read a bunch of Marcy Wheeler for a lot of details of this stuff and catch up. But it seems to me like, I guess they're saying the Russians were offering these emails. It doesn't seem like when you read the thing that they ever delivered them. They were trying to have a meeting with Trump. That seems like a very above board thing. What, they're going to have a secret meeting with Trump where they hand deliver him the emails or something? They try to make something that, to me, sounds innocuous sound like some kind of felony.
Well, you know what it could have been like? It was the enticement to get the meeting, the same with Don Jr. That woman, it wasn't even the woman. It was this British rock promoter who doesn't speak for the Kremlin, who said they had the dirt on Clinton.
Right.
And then when they got there, there was no dirt on Clinton. They just wanted to talk about the Magnitsky Act. So this could have been just to get the meeting between Trump.
In other words, all the little nefarious anecdotes, when you add them all together, they equal zero. It's all a bunch of it all reveals what's not there, which is some Kremlin effort overall to, you know, tilt the balance in favor of the Trump campaign. And in both cases here, it looks like even in this thing that came out today, he went to them. And he was talking to some professor and was like, hey, I'm working for Trump, guys, and all of this stuff, and struck up the relationship with them in the first place. So, and then also, I want to point out, too, and Sheldon Richman went and found this from earlier this morning, because I had told him this was true just from memory, and he went and found the citation that, you know, and I know you know the story very well. We can't, and I'm sorry, I'm really late, but I got to shoehorn this in at the end of your interview here, that when Manafort was working for Yanukovych, the president of Ukraine, he was strongly urging Yanukovych to sign the deal with the EU, even when it was, they changed it to be exclusionary of the Russians, that you can't also have a free trade deal with the Russians. It can only be with us. And that Manafort was putting real pressure on them, basically pushing the American line on them. And that then, the quote was that he urged them to press ahead with the EU integration agenda. And then there was one more. Manafort was the person dragging Yanukovych to the West. The joke inside the Party of Regions, that's Yanukovych's party, was that Manafort was actually from the CIA, that he was there clearly pushing Western interests on Ukraine. So now, but supposedly we're supposed to read this entirely the other way, that the Russians were using the Ukrainian government, which was friendly to Russia, but not a sock puppet government of the Russians, but they were using the government of Kiev to control this guy Manafort because in a couple of years he's going to be an advisor to Trump or something. And meanwhile, all they have is he bought a bunch of rugs. He laundered a bunch of money and he didn't pay his taxes. They're starting to try to make him sound like a hero to me.
Well, you summed it up very well there.
All right. Hey, listen, man, you do great work. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us today on the show, Joe.
Talk to you again.
All right, take care. All right, you guys, that's a great Joe Laura. Hey, listen, read this thing he wrote. It's at consortiumnews.com. The Democratic money behind Russiagate. Ha ha. Hoisted on your own petard, lady. How do you like that? Joe Laura has written for the Boston Globe, the Sunday Times in London, and the Wall Street Journal. And he wrote the book, How I Lost, by Hillary Clinton. It's really worth a read. You'll love it. It's really great. The whole time you read it, you'll be like, ha 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 ha. Pointing your finger and laughing. All right, bye.